This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Gibbon.
I'm an accidental sportscaster.
Do you recognize that voice? No? Let's try again.
I'm an accidental sportscaster.
Here's some more clues. He's been heard by millions of football, basketball, Olympics, and golf viewers over the past 50 years. You might have heard him during 1992's March Madness.
There's the pass to Leitner. Puts it up. Yes!
Or the 2005 Masters. But he also played a minor role in the coverage of a national crisis almost exactly 55 years ago. Here's Only a Game's Gary Wallach.
Vern Lundquist grew up loving sports. He was the sports editor of his junior high and high school newspapers in Austin, Texas. But what he really wanted was to be an athlete.
I mean, I was 5'3", 115 pounds. Tried out for the basketball team. Made the junior varsity my sophomore year, tried out again my junior year, and finally the coach came over and put his arm around me and said, I've got a suggestion. Why don't you become a cheerleader?
He didn't, but Lundquist did begin to consider other career paths. His father was a Lutheran minister, so Vern thought he might attend seminary. But one day, he paid a visit with his father to a radio station.
And I was just mesmerized by the studio and the men who were lucky enough to go on the air.
He loved being surrounded by an array of dials, switches, meters, and lights. Lundquist enrolled at Texas Lutheran College as a sociology major. He still thought he might go on to seminary, but he couldn't stop thinking about radio. He got a gig at KWED in Seguin, Texas.
I would put the station on the air 5:45, 6 in the morning, and shut it down at sunset. And my senior year, got a job as a weekend disc jockey and announcer. I was blessed with my father's pipes, and also blessed, I think, with a lack of fear of addressing an audience. I'd watched him in the pulpit growing up, and thank God I inherited that trait as well.
Lundquist did attend seminary in Illinois for 1 year. In the spring of 1963, he realized that wasn't his true calling. So he returned to Austin, where he was hired by KTBC as a weekend TV sports news anchor and a radio DJ. He was just 23 years old. To round out his 40-hour work week, he sometimes ran the board during radio news broadcasts.
And I was doing that on the afternoon of November 22nd, 1963. My assignment was to be in the control room at noon. We'd do a live newscast. Then they would have the weather forecast. And the last 15 minutes, they would play a tape of that day's agricultural report.
The agricultural report began at 12:25. Then at 12:30...
Hal Nelson, one of our radio newscast guys, broke into the control room and said, put me on the air immediately. The president has been shot.
Nelson gave live updates until KTBC switched to live national coverage from CBS Radio, anchored by Walter Cronkite.
Here's a bulletin from CBS News. President Kennedy has been the victim of an assassin's bullets in Dallas, Texas. It is not known as yet whether the president survived the attack against him.
The shooting had taken place just 200 miles away, and the station was owned by Lyndon and Lady Bird Johnson.
We had a five-story building at 10th and Brazos in downtown Austin. Within a half an hour, we had Secret Service agents on every floor, guarding every exit, guarding the elevators, guarding especially the front and back entrances and exits from the studios. And there was some concern, even then, that quickly, that it could be an attempted coup.
Lundquist couldn't leave the building, so he drifted into the newsroom, where he stood transfixed before the black and white television.
And I saw Walter Cronkite remove his black eyeglasses and wipe a tear out away.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy
died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago. Vice President Lyndon Johnson.
The sense of loss was overwhelming. I don't think I ever stopped and cried. I don't remember doing that. But there were shared moments with my colleagues of grief over what this one man had done to alter the course of our history.
The Texas high school football playoffs were postponed 1 week. On the night of Friday, November 29th, Lundquist was assigned to gather footage of a local game for his weekend TV sports broadcast.
And I shot all my own film back then. I mean, I was a one-man band. And I can remember getting in my car and driving to Taylor, Texas, about 20 miles outside of Austin, and standing on the sidelines filming a playoff game between the Hutto Hippos and the Taylor Ducks. And I can remember standing there as a young man, really immersed in grief, thinking this is such a wrong thing to do.
There had been debate over whether the playoffs should proceed in the wake of the assassination.
I guess you could argue, well, life's got to go on. But I thought it was desperately inappropriate.
Lundquist shot the footage and used it in his Saturday report. During his following 3 years at KTBC, he thought a lot about the events of November 22, 1963, how Cronkite had covered them, and what it all meant.
The assassination made me aware of a much, much wider world than who beat whom in the NFL or college football.
Lundquist began to think that a position as a news anchor and not a sports anchor would be a more suitable career.
I was offered a position at WOAI in San Antonio to anchor the 6 and 10 o'clock newscast. And I took the position thinking, well, this will be more dignified than sports. That was a mistake on my part.
It was a mistake, he says, because WOAI followed the news model used by so many other local television stations. If it bleeds, it leads. He couldn't stand that the top story was usually a car crash, a fire, or a murder. And he began to miss sports. Lundquist left WOAI less than a year after he'd started there. He began hosting Dallas Cowboys pre- and post-game radio broadcasts in 1967. He's been calling lots of sporting events ever since.
Blitz, screen pass, Yeldon, to the 20, to the 10, touchdown Alabama!
Lundquist is 78 now. He says he realizes how fortunate he is to have made the right career choice, thanks in part to a sense of perspective he gained when he dabbled in the world of the so-called real news.
That's Only a Game's Gary Wallach. Vern Lundquist's new book is Play-by-Play, Calling the Wildest Games in Sports. All hell will break loose. That's what University of Maryland President Wallace Lowe told the Board of Regents about what would happen if football coach DJ Durkin was reinstated. And that's where we're going to start this week on Three Stories You Should Know. I'm joined by the Boston Globe's Nora Princiati and the Wall Street Journal's Jason Gay. Welcome back to both of you.
Hi, Karen.
Thank you.
So I was totally sucked into the Maryland House Appropriations Committee meeting this week. That's a sentence I never thought I'd say. Just to recap, Maryland lineman Jordan McNair died of heat stroke last spring. Investigations found instances of what I'm going to describe as abusive treatment of players. The head coach was briefly reinstated, then fired, and the university president is retiring but won't really say why. But what that university president will say to lawmakers under oath is that a university chancellor ignored his recommendation to fire coach DJ Durkin and overstepped by bringing the coach back. And it might be totally silly of me, but I have this hope that this whole thing puts those who would put winning football games over the health and safety of players on notice. Jason, I know you're going to tell me I'm being far too optimistic, so go ahead.
You might be being far too optimistic. This is yet another example of the sort of
win-it-all-cost culture, which, you know, is pervasive in college sports. And you look at a program like Maryland, joined the Big Ten a handful of years ago with big plans on improving and growing its footprint in the world of football. Hasn't panned out that way, but when you see the kind of conflict that was happening at the institutional level between the board, between the president, you realize the stakes that are involved and how warped the system has become.
I have a note in front of me that says, Maryland is playing Ohio State this weekend, smiley face, smiley face. So that's two programs that have been embroiled in scandal over the past year. And while a player didn't die on Coach Urban Meyer's watch, which I think is an important distinction, he was fairly clearly involved in protecting an assistant coach who was credibly accused of domestic violence. He's going to be on the sideline this weekend. And I think that can pretty much be boiled down to the fact that Urban Meyer has like a 79-9 record. And DJ Durkin, I think, was 11-15.
Right.
So, no, I don't think that this is representative of some shift in college athletics
right.
where everyone's going to try to do the right thing now.
You know, every time something awful like this happens, I always find myself thinking, this is the tipping point. This is the moment. And I am always disappointed. Nora, you're up.
The deadline passed for Steelers running back Le'Veon Bell to join his team, play out the rest of the season. Instead, he chose not to report, forfeits $14.5 million that he would have earned fully guaranteed by playing under the franchise tag. His teammates in the locker room, they went through his stuff, but they were all, you know, getting caught on video saying, thanks for the Jordans.
Well, appreciate the click, man. I'm taking all off and on, bro. Much love.
You know, I think it was mostly all in good fun. But the thing that's interesting about that to me is that the whole reason this is compelling is that this is a player who's taking a stand for himself in an environment of professional football that really discourages that. And we're seeing that get tested a little bit. And it's been really interesting to watch because I think maybe it'll tell us something about whether or not this kind of thing can actually force changes. But I'm sort of curious just sort of what you guys think about going into people's stuff. I mean, Karen, what would someone find at your desk if you ran out of the office and everyone was ransacking your things?
They'd get my bobbleheads. It would be terrible. Jason?
Well, I'd have a lot of Skittles. People would have to share the Skittles.
Oh, that's good.
I think you're exactly right that what this is about is the tension between player rights and what has been a long-standing advantage for the ownership in the NFL. And I think the owners must have been thrilled to watch the Steelers ransack Le'Veon Bell's locker. They love the idea of Le'Veon Bell being demonized somehow as a guy who let down his team rather than someone sticking up for individual player rights.
Well, and that video, I mean, when I watched the video of them taking the stuff, I mean, if you can steal someone's stuff out of love. It seemed like, you know, they were saying, hey, thanks for this, man. Love ya. You know, and maybe that was just for show. But I think it does bring up an interesting question, because for you and I, the idea of walking away from $14.5 million and saying it isn't enough seems kind of crazy. But we're not in an industry where the words career-ending injury apply,
sure.
You know?
Sure.
It's a completely different thing.
Right.
And that's where he's saying, you know, I play this incredibly dangerous position.
Right.
It takes one play for a ligament to tear. So he's foregoing this year to get a contract that it's not about it being bigger. It's about it having more guaranteed money. And that's a direct reflection of the fact that he's prioritizing protecting himself against a serious injury.
Jason, it's your turn.
All right. I have a question for you that is strictly rhetorical. How do you know when you are too big?
Ooh.
When you can get people to pay to see you even when they can't see you. This is the conceit behind a new gimmick from the Golden State Warriors, Earth's most desirable basketball team and the winner of the last 3 out of 4 NBA titles. The Warriors have a ticket waiting list that has more names than a small industrial city. So they've introduced something called the Building Pass, which for the price of $100 a month entitles its bearer access to the Warriors' home court, the Oracle Arena. That's right. You can get in. You can breathe the same oxygen as Steph Curry and Klay Thompson, but you can't see the game. The only assured way you'll have to see the game is watching one of those sad TV sets that hangs over the $10 hot dog stand. So, if you can imagine, as the Warriors are playing, you're instead roaming the corridors of Oracle Arena like a basketball Miss Havisham, denied the glory, denied the firsthand glory of watching Steph and Klay launch from 40 feet. Is this hubris? Is it absurdist capitalism? Probably a little bit of both.
I took a few minutes out of my day, which maybe I'll come to regret, and looked up the food options and Yelp reviews at Oracle Arena. I'll just tell you that it has a 1.5 star rating on Yelp in terms of concessions. Here's one. I'm totally a fan of the fried chicken tenders / garlic fries at Oracle Arena on the second floor by the Coors Light Bar.
Nice.
So potentially that's where people can be sitting at the Coors Light Bar and not watching the game. So I just want to warn people, if they're thinking about investing in one of these passes, that you're not getting access to a particularly comfortable or gourmet experience.
I mean, it's interesting that you point that out, because I got to say, on first blush, my thought was, what is the big deal? I mean, people pay for those party passes at Cowboys Stadium. And if you've ever seen the videos, I mean, they like stampede into the building. And some of them are stampeding to get an actual view of the field.
Yeah.
But some of them are just stampeding to get a view of a television set. But the difference probably is that those areas, I mean, I've been there. They're super nice. They're bright. They're happy. So it does seem like maybe they are offering a few more amenities.
Also, I think it's very important that the possibility of seeing the field exists.
And from the sounds of those Yelp reviews, you're going to gain 90 pounds.
Oh.
It seemed bleak.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been the Boston Globe's Nora Princiotti and the Wall Street Journal's Jason Gay. Thanks to both of you.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
You're listening to Only a Game from NPR.
This message comes from Only a Game sponsor, Samuel Adams. Of all the beers Sam Adams has ever brewed, Boston Lager is their all-time favorite. With its distinctive balance of spicy hops, sweet roasted malts, and smooth finish, it stood the test of time and helped launch the whole craft beer revolution. Sam Adams Boston Lager. Full-flavored, rich, and complex. There's nothing quite like the taste of an original. Boston Beer Company, Boston, Mass. Savor responsibly.
I'm Ophira Eisenberg. Join me on NPR's Ask Me Another as we challenge contestants and celebrities to nerdy word games, music parodies, and ponderful trivia. Find us every week on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Karen Given. 87-year-old George Whitmore lives in Fresno, California.
Born here, still here.
When George was 5 or 6 years old, his parents took him to the bridge across Lower Yosemite Falls. They looked up at a two-tiered cascade of water thundering over a cliff, kicking up a canopy of mist over those standing below.
I was pretty small, and I was surrounded by all these big people who were looking up. And I wondered, what are they looking at? They were looking up on the cliffs way up high. And I was told, they're looking at the climbers up there. I was very frustrated because I could not see any climbers. And that was my first exposure to rock climbing.
2 decades later, George Whitmore would join one of the most accomplished climbers of his era to take on one of Yosemite's most iconic features. Susan Vallett has the story. In the early 1950s, there were very few people rock climbing. The activity tended to attract rebels, shall we say, people who marched to a different drummer. Two of those people happened to be George Whitmore's housemates in San Francisco.
They said, well, why don't you come out to one of our practice climbs? We're having one this Sunday. And then if you went to enough practice climbs and learned enough, then you would be allowed to go up to Yosemite with them.
Meanwhile, in the tiny rock climbing community, a bit of rivalry started between two fierce competitors, Warren Harding and Royal Robbins.
Robbins was an athlete, like the first real rock athlete in the United States, at least operating in Yosemite on that level.
That's author John Long. He's written about the history of climbing. Long says Robbins was a free climber. He wanted to make his way up the rock with as little equipment as possible.
Harding didn't care about free climbing. He didn't care about putting bolts in the wall. He didn't really care about anything but getting up things. You know, each wanted to outdo the other one, and so it went, and that's what drove a lot of the technology and the technique and the development of the sport, is those two guys going about their business in different ways.
The battleground was Yosemite National Park, with its valley surrounded by a cathedral of steep granite cliff faces. Warren had wanted to be the first to climb the face of Half Dome, the sliced rock made famous by Ansel Adams' photography. But in July of 1957, Royal Robbins' team got there first. Warren is said to have met them at the top to congratulate them, but
2 days later, he said, "I'm going after El Cap." So he lost Half Dome, but he was going to go for the bigger one, which is El Cap.
El Cap, as in El Capitan. The two sides of a cliff come together in a nose shape, stretching down the bottom. That's the route Warren and his crew plan to take, the nose. Warren Harding died in 2002, but he described the climb in a report he wrote for American Alpine Club in 1959. We asked an actor to read his words.
"We spent an entire day studying the face in search of a continuous route to the summit. It was obvious that existing methods of conducting a sustained rock climb would be inadequate. Because of the extreme difficulty of the climb, we anticipated slow progress, perhaps no more than 100 to 200 feet a day."
Long says El Capitan was considered the greatest prize in rock climbing. It's steep, it's long, and large cracks in the granite block the path. At times, you'd have to hang upside down to work your way up.
"It's just scary as hell up there, man. You're talking about way thousands of feet up the ground with just the gnarliest, least effective gear you could ever imagine. I mean, really just winging it up there."
Warren and a couple others began their first attempt on July 4th, 1957.
"There was no thought of reaching the summit. Our tentative goal was El Cap Towers, the prominent pinnacles on the east side of the buttress, about halfway up the face. The climbing was almost entirely sixth class, direct aid, and about as difficult as can be imagined."
That first attempt lasted only 3 days.
"Our special stove leg pitons, which had brought us up 300 feet of the 2 to 3 inch wide stove leg crack, would no longer hold."
A piton is a type of anchor, a piece of metal that a rock climber drives into a crack that's too narrow for an arm or a leg. Again, climbing author John Long.
"They didn't have anything that would fit the crack, and nobody could free climb because it's vertical 2 to 3 inch. There's no way for them to make any progress. They had to retreat and try to fashion something that they could beat into the crack."
150 feet short of the lower tower, we were forced to give up. Leaving fixed rope behind to secure what we had gained, we descended. Reaching the ground, our spirits were somewhat dampened by an unexpected problem. It seemed that our climb presented quite a spectacle and had attracted a crowd of tourists, which created a traffic jam at the road junction near the base."
I mean, it was such a freaky, sort of otherworldly kind of thing that even back in those days, Yosemite was fairly crowded with car travel, and, you know, half of it was parked in El Cap Meadow. Everybody wanting to get a peek of these maniacs up on El Cap trying to climb the thing.
Because of the crowds, park rangers banned climbing between Memorial Day and Labor Day, so the team had to pack it in for the year. In spring of 1958, Harding tried again with a new team. One of the members was Richard Calderwood.
"I thought it was quite an adventure."
Calderwood's main job was mostly to ferry supplies and clean up the rope behind them.
"I did a lot of cargo carrying and load ferrying, kind of a porter or a Sherpa, as it were. I was working all by myself. That was kind of trippy. You know, up there a couple of thousand feet off the ground, just having to really be sure that I was doing everything right and that I wasn't making any mistakes, because a mistake could be fatal."
George Whitmore was also on the climb. He'd come a long way since his San Francisco housemates had taken him on Yosemite practice climbs. Whitmore also hauled supplies, including extra bolts.
At that time, they didn't have these portable ledges like they have now. You either spent the night hanging in rope slings, or you found a ledge that you could lie down on or sit on. You would sort of sat there with your legs dangling over the edge, and that was how you spent the night, just sort of sitting and leaning back.
This time around, they were doing what Warren called a series of attrition attacks, weekend climbing adventures meant to set ropes high enough on the rock face so that a final push would have a chance of success.
If anything had happened to us, it was up to us to take care of it ourselves. Nobody was going to come after us. Nobody was going to rescue us. The type of climbing you're doing is beyond what anybody has had any experience with. You guys are on your own.
As the climb continued, it became clear that the team would need to develop new climbing methods if they were to reach the top.
I had prusiked before, which is the process of sliding knots up the rope and standing in stirrups and so forth and a harness and working your way up the fixed rope. But I'd never done it on a rope that was anchored, say, 150 feet above. There's a lot of stretch of the rope. I remember pushing the knots up and putting my weight on it, and I didn't go off the ground. I did it again. I was still on the ground. It took quite a while before all the stretch came out.
At that point, climbers hung from the waist, which made it hard to lug gear quickly. So Calderwood started thinking of ways to improve their equipment and technique. He designed and built a chest harness, which he sewed out of salvaged seat belts.
And we made faster progress.
But still, for George Whitmore and the rest of the crew, it wasn't fast enough.
We would take so long, you know, we would be at work or in school, then we'd go up there Friday night, Saturday morning, start up the ropes, get up to the high point, and push the high point a little bit, and then have to start back down and go back to school and work. And it was getting to the point of diminishing returns. We were expending the huge amounts of time and effort and making very small incremental progress.
One Sunday evening, Warren came down from the weekend climb, again, not getting very far. He was frustrated.
And as he was dropping this gear that was wrapped all around him, he said, "I'm getting sick, sick, sick of going up and down these goddamn ropes. Let's go up there and stay with it until we finish it, or it finishes us."
On November 1st, 1958, we started up the fixed ropes for what we hoped would be the last time.
Winter was coming. It was now or never. But before the team reached the top, Richard Calderwood decided the answer was never.
I was married and had a baby on the way. And I was off on this adventure. And the adventure was very exciting and I was enjoying it, but it seemed selfish in terms of the responsibilities I had to go playing around seeking adventure when I perhaps ought to be supporting a family.
Calderwood says he developed a lot of anxiety over what to do. He didn't want to stay. He didn't want to quit. And most of the time, he was alone on the rock face with a lot of time to think.
So, yeah, I'd have a lonesome night to think. And reflect and look at the cars going around down in the valley and so forth.
So Calderwood went home, and Harding, Whitmore, and Mary pushed on. Whitmore remembers one night when they were getting close to the top. It stormed. Remember, winter's coming? And he got wet.
So in the morning, I was drying my stuff out. So I got a late start going up the ropes. And when I got up to Camp 6, which is where I expected to find them, there was a note tied to the rope. "George, we're going for the top. Come on up." "Okay." It was dusk. "Okay, keep on going."
Whitmore knew the lead climbing team would soon run out of bolts, so he brought some along. As he climbed higher, he found them waiting for him.
Warren, here was Warren up in under those overhangs, and it was pretty dark by then, but you could see this little dark spot up there under the overhangs. That was Warren. "Did you bring some bolts?" "Yes." "Boy, are we glad to see you." And then Warren spent the night driving these bolts over the final overhangs, topped out as the sun was coming up.
As I hammered in the last bolt and staggered over the rim, it was not clear to me who was conqueror and who was conquered. I do recall that El Cap seemed to be in much better condition than I was.
When all three of us got on top and our two friends were there, yes, they had a bottle of champagne, and they had three champagne glasses. Real glasses, not plastic.
That climb up El Capitan didn't only bring innovation in gear, but author John Long says it also brought a new way of thinking about big wall climbing.
It's really like walking on the moon. It's one of those things that happened, like Greg Noll surfing Waimea Bay the first time. Or, you know, there's certain things that happen that are seminal events, not just for climbers or surfers or astronauts, but for all mankind, and that was one of them. It revolutionized what everybody thought was possible.
Warren Harding and his crew reached the top of El Capitan 60 years ago this month. It took them 45 days over 18 months. Today, it takes just a few days to climb that same route. At night, you can see their tiny beams of light from the Yosemite Valley, beckoning new climbers to take on the adventure.
That's reporter Susan Vallett. The owner of a bluegrass radio station in Mount Airy, North Carolina, recently stumbled across some old records.
We went about as viral as you can in this area with our broadcast. Mm-hmm.
The story of a 70-year-old football game is just ahead on Only a Game. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
How often do people lie on dating apps? And are robots taking over our jobs? I'm Cardiff Garcia, co-host of Planet Money's The Indicator, where every day we tell you a short story about the economy. Get it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game, our second annual Thanksgiving leftover show. Believe me, like your great aunt's pecan pie, you don't want to miss this one. But now I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Karen.
Wilt Chamberlain is no longer number 5 on the NBA's all-time scoring list. That honor now belongs to LeBron James. LeBron marked the occasion by saying nice things about Wilt. Would you like to mark the occasion by saying nice things about LeBron?
I was stunned that Wilt was already dropped to 5th, to be perfectly honest with you. LeBron James has Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's record in his sights. He's 3.5 years away, assuming he doesn't either go off and become a Buddhist monk or, you know, buy the world or fall out of shape. And that's going to be an astonishing accomplishment.
Lakers coach Luke Walton took the opportunity to complain about the refs. He said he could probably shoot 100 free throws a game if everything was called. It's not that I disagree with this. I just don't remember Walton ever complaining about that when LeBron played for the competition.
Well, that's the thing. What Luke Walton is saying is what everyone who's ever coached LeBron James going back to high school has said.
Right.
So, I mean, everybody should accept it, I think. I mean, LeBron seems to have accepted it, you know, as much as one can when one is the object of all this pounding. But I think everyone else should accept that this is going to be the way it is for the rest of his career.
After just 10 games with the Houston Rockets, Carmelo Anthony is once again looking for a new job. I guess when you know, right?
He's going to go down in history as one of the great mysteries. He was a terrific player. He could well have been the kind of player who carries a team when he came out of the draft, in the same draft, by the way, that LeBron James and Dwayne Wade came out in. He just never found a niche. I mean, he's being criticized basically for not having had a Hall of Fame career, which is really kind of a high bar when you think about it. But he just never found a team that was comfortable with him and with which he was comfortable. And it's a very odd biography he has as an NBA player.
Monday night's NFL game between the Kansas City Chiefs and the LA Rams will not take place in Mexico City as planned. Officials say the field conditions there are unsafe. Fans are upset, but as I understand it, the players are happy.
The players are thrilled, and so are the people in Los Angeles, because tickets are being given away to first responders and people whose lives have been affected by the ongoing wildfires out there, which is a good thing. The other thing you have to remember is this is the marquee regular season game of the year,
right,
between the Rams and the Chiefs. And you can't have that on a field that looks like chicken chow mein. You can't do that. So this is a decision I am wholly behind as far as the NFL is concerned.
With all its resources, shouldn't the NFL have been able to prevent this from happening?
The rain? I don't think they can do that.
Fair point.
I'll ask. I'll look and see in Roger Goodell's contract if he's empowered to stop rain. But it was bound to happen. The stadium that they were going to use, the Estadio Azteca, is used for everything,
yeah,
including soccer game after soccer game after soccer game. And it was bound to happen sooner or later. I am happy, as somebody who will watch this game, I'm happy that the two best offenses in the NFL are going to play against each other on a field worthy of their talent.
Another city has declined to participate in the great economic growth driver known as the Olympic Games. Which is the smart city this time?
Calgary, which actually put on a great Olympics, yeah, in 1988, but has decided that it's going to stand pat on those memories and not pony up for the Olympics in 2026, despite the fact that the people who want to put the Olympics in there spent close to $8 million,
yeah,
in an advertising campaign to win the referendum, and it lost. So I think we can clearly say the people in Calgary were very happy in 1988. And very happy now that the Winter Olympics will be going somewhere else.
Well, one expert says that the IOC will reject its two remaining bids, which are Stockholm and a combined Italian bid, and instead turn to, wait for it, Salt Lake City.
Oh, good Lord. And Mitt's already in the Senate, so he can take a couple of weeks off and run himself a new Olympics.
Serena Williams is GQ's Woman of the Year. Good choice?
Yes, of course it is. I mean, she's the dominant athlete in her sport. She's a groundbreaker in six or eight different ways. She's an entrepreneur. She's a voice for equality. She's just a terrific athlete and a terrific human being in the moment right now. And I couldn't agree more with GQ's choice. Although I don't know why woman has to go in quote marks.
Right.
And I would like some clarification from GQ.
Yeah, it's really weird. They say, oh, it's a designer and that's his thing and he did it in his own hand. But it seems like a pretty shoddy...
Why the quote marks? You can do it with you can pin it on the design guy just scratching it out and putting woman, because that would be kind of funny and would be kind of a GQ's own joke on itself. The quote marks, I'm not too sure about, no.
And finally, Charlie, Law 8 of the English Football Association requires the referee toss a coin at the beginning of every match. And why am I citing Law 8 of the English Football Association?
Because a referee named David McNamara forgot the coin. He left it in the official's dressing room. So instead, he had the respective captains play rock, paper, scissors to decide who would kick off to whom. He's been suspended for 21 days.
It's crazy.
It's nuts. I mean, how much more arbitrary is rock, paper, scissors than tossing a coin?
And it's totally more fun.
It's absolutely more fun. There's no question about that. And it requires you to think a little bit because you have to... There's strategy to rock, paper, scissors.
Right.
There's no strategy to calling a coin.
No. You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Sports Illustrated, and he joins us each week on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Karen.
All right, we're going to try something new and close out this week's show with some bluegrass music. Well, there will be some high school football thrown in, too, I promise. Here's Only a Game's Martin Kessler.
For the past 70 years, WPAQ out of Mount Airy, North Carolina, population 10,000, has broadcast bluegrass and old-time string music. But music isn't all you'll hear on WPAQ.
The folks call in and say they've lost an animal or they found an animal. We will be happy to announce that.
That's Brack Llewellyn, a part-time announcer who's worked on and off at the station since the 80s. When we spoke recently, Brack had just finished reading the local obituaries, something WPAQ announcers do 2 to 3 times every day. And on Sundays, you'll hear programming like this.
It's such a privilege to be over the airways with you today, my beloved.
We've had a lot of preachers.
That's WPAQ owner and general manager Kelly Epperson.
They come in live on Sundays.
Well, and then what about Friday nights?
Oh, yeah. Friday night is big for our radio station.
Now, live from Wallace Shelton Stadium on the campus of Mount Airy High School, here's Kelly Epperson and Tommy Morrison.
On Friday nights in the fall, WPAQ, your home for the best bluegrass and old-time string music, transforms into the home of the Mount Airy Bears high school football team.
Well, we have people that actually didn't intend on becoming fans of Bears football that listen from out of town, that have become interested because they hear it all the time.
Now, you might think this is just a story about a 10,000-watt radio station that's converting fans of bluegrass into supporters of the football team from a 550-student high school. But it's more than that, partly because of Mount Airy's own history, and mostly because of something that Kelly Epperson recently discovered. Kelly Epperson took over WPAQ from his father, Ralph, who died in 2006. A few weeks ago, he was digging around his father's old office.
My dad, he held on to everything. It drove my mom crazy. And actually, in the corner, I saw a box that was sort of halfway open, and I kind of kicked at it a little bit just to make sure there were no snakes around, and because we have a lot of black snakes up here. But anyway, it was heavy. And I opened up the lid. There were some records in there, and I looked at the label, and I couldn't believe it. It said, Mount Airy versus Laurinburg, football, November 25th, 1948.
It was the state championship, held on Thanksgiving Day. Kelly didn't have the equipment at WPAQ to play the records. They're old lacquer discs, but he took them to a woman who did.
And I remember the very first moment when she put the needle down on one of the records, and I just could not believe my ears.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Mount Airy High School football band has just left the field. Proceedings are underway here to open this state Class A championship game.
And I just looked down watching this spin around, these records spin around, listening to this, thinking, this is amazing.
The fact that this recording was from 1948 isn't a coincidence. That was the year Mount Airy, North Carolina got its first radio station. Mount Airy is located in the foothills of the Blue Ridge Mountains, right on the Virginia border. Ralph Epperson, that's Kelly's father, grew up on a tobacco farm about 10 miles away in Ararat, Virginia. Ralph liked two things, the bluegrass and string music native to the area, and radio.
He just thought, well, you know, it'd be great if we could have a radio station. So his father backed him on it. They actually went to the First National Bank in Mount Airy and got a $38,000 loan.
Ralph and his father built the station themselves. Ralph's dad was well qualified for the job. He also made coffins. On February 2nd, 1948, WPAQ went on the air. 13 years later, in 1961, Kelly was born.
They changed my diaper here in the radio station many, many times.
It's part of the WPAQ lore.
That's it.
It really is.
Back then, there was a lot of industry around Mount Airy. Textile mills, furniture factories, a granite quarry.
Yeah, I remember hearing those loud whistles from the various factories, you know, letting folks know it was time to come to work at 7 a.m. And every day at 12 noon, you'd hear those whistles go off again for lunch.
There were so many jobs available that if you got angry at your boss where you were, you could quit your job, literally drive across town and get another job before the day was out.
That is true.
Brack says that during the boom times, Mount Airy's 3.5-block downtown had 4 different pharmacies and 3 or 4 different shoe stores. But he says in the late 80s and 90s, that started to change.
Kind of one by one over a fairly short period of time, you began to see the local mills being acquired by other companies. Almost every time the new owners would come in, and the first thing they would do is reassure everyone that nothing was going to change. That almost meant certainly that everything was going to change.
Brack says the textile mill started moving out of state or out of the country.
It was like watching a dam burst. I mean, you just couldn't stop it.
But while the jobs were going away, some things stayed the same.
There was still this great want and need for and love for this kind of music. That never went away.
I think maybe we brought some comfort to folks.
And there was still Mount Airy High School football.
There were factories within sight of the football stadium closing down, but for that few hours on Friday night, you'd think everything was just exactly as it should be.
Brack and Kelly say the economy has come a long way since those down times. There's now a tourist industry built around the fact that Mount Airy was the inspiration for Mayberry, the setting for the Andy Griffith Show. People in Mount Airy may no longer need WPAQ or the football team in quite the same way they used to. But when Kelly Epperson discovered those old lacquer discs in the corner of his dad's office, he knew he'd found something that mattered to the community. So when did you get the idea to rebroadcast this game?
Oh, that was immediate.
The 2018 Mount Airy Bears had a bye week coming up. There was a Friday night open on WPAQ's calendar. So on September 28th at 7:30, when residents of Mount Airy, North Carolina, turned to 7:40 on their AM dials, they heard this.
N.W. Quick, co-captain and right tackle of the Laurinburg Scots from Scotland County, the Fighting Scots they're called, will be kicking off for Laurinburg on the 40-yard line.
I don't want to give away what all happens during this broadcast, but I'll tell you, there were moments that my emotions were just coming out. I mean, I was laughing at some of the expressions.
The ball, it's a pass, it's a long pass, it's a sweeper, and he misses it. There was the play. Pat Kelly has the ball and is going for an appreciable gain to go over. No, he's tackled from behind by a host of Mount Airy ball tacklers, four of them to be exact. The field, by the way, the condition of this field is very sloppy, muddy and miry.
Tell me what happened. When did you guys first start hearing from people?
Instantaneously.
We went about as viral as you can in this area with our broadcast.
Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to concentrate. I was running the board, and I was getting all these messages. They were blowing up my phone. I couldn't handle it.
And what were they saying?
Saying, this is unbelievable. I'm hearing my dad play. I never thought I could ever do this. My dad is playing a football game.
Brack says he heard from one friend who grew up in Laurinburg and recognized the name of a player on the Scots roster.
And the player whose name he heard grew up to be the doctor who delivered him.
One curious listener even showed up at the station.
And scared me to death.
Brief scares notwithstanding, Kelly says the night was joyful. Kelly, I'm curious, what do you think your father would have thought of all of this?
He'd say, fascinating. That's one of his words. That's fascinating. And he would be overwhelmed with bliss.
Those of us that work here feel like Ralph is still with us. And when Kelly said he discovered these records with this game on it, it crossed my mind. I thought, Ralph had a hand in this. He led Kelly to that box.
And I'd tell you how the game ends, but I don't want to spoil it, because you're going to get another chance to listen. WPAQ is rebroadcasting the game one more time this Thanksgiving Day at 2 p.m. Eastern Time.
So who wants to watch the Detroit Lions when they can hear the 1948 North Carolina 1A state championship game?
We'll have info on how to tune in to WPAQ's Thanksgiving rebroadcast on onlyagame.org. That story was from Only a Game's Martin Kessler.
Real quick, though, before I let you guys go,
yeah.
Tell me about these black snakes. They sound kind of scary.
Oh, the world's greatest population of black snakes. They're here.
One time, I recall, one of the snakes got into our transmitter.
Oh, my.
And literally knocked the station off the air.
We were off for days.
Yes. And we had a local fella, Charlie Hoover. Charlie's still with us. And if we see one, we call Charlie, and he comes and takes the snake out for us.
Yeah, we don't dispose of the snakes. He just comes and captures them and takes them to somewhere else.
I'm pretty sure Martin thinks we're making all this up now.
This is real. I'll vouch for it.
Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach, with help from Matthew Stock. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our senior producer is me. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.